the Pyramid One Radio Network. Let me tell you about this new show called Highway to Recovery. It has two hosts. Yes, co-hosts. Let me tell you about the first one. Her name is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. She shares in casual conversation topics of health, wellness, and spirituality to transform your life. Her guests are authors, physicians, spiritual leaders, and people who wish to share a message of hope as the world evolves through daily challenges. The conversations may ease your concerns, encourage deep laughter, or challenge your beliefs, but you will come away with a sense of something has stirred inside of you, and you just can't wait to share it with others. Dr. Jeanette's book, Trust, Photo Meditations, is an inspirational journey to find the softness and comfort in the world around us. Dr. Jeanette is a visionary, spiritual guide, an inspirational author, and radio host. Her specialty is in helping others remember that life, our life, is a great gift. No matter what we are going through, Dr. Jeanette is in the healing of the heart and spirit business and loves every moment. Now, myself, Bob Charles. As a radio host, I believe people have the right to be heard, and on my radio shows, I always let people in our glorious world speak through the guests I bring on this show. I also have promised myself that I will never, ever allow the show to sound like other shows, as we all have a voice, and all of the voices you hear are different. The world is listening. Hi, and welcome to Highway to Recovery. Let me tell you about the guest coming up. His name is Scott Stevens. Stevens is a journalist, posting regularly on health and alcohol issues for online news services, and is a founding influencer at the world's largest medical portal, HealthTap. Stevens adds his stunning personal 86-proof 2-liter-a-day story with thorough research into alcoholism, sobriety, relapse, and recovery. A former mutual fund industry executive, Stevens blends wit, journalistic objectivity, blunt personal dialogue, and no-nonsense business perspective in his three books. 2010's What the Early World Worm Gets, 2013's Indie Book Awards Finalist, Every Silver Lining Has a Cloud, and in 2015's USA Best Books Awards finalist, Adding Fire to the Fuel, which also won the 2016 Book Excellence Award. His fourth book, 2016's I Can't See the Forest with All These Damn Trees in the Way, takes on alcohol and health policy against the backdrop of Surgeon General's report on alcohol, drugs, and health. He regularly addresses conferences around the country, including the Real Recovery Film Festival, on the latest trends in the field of alcohol use disorders. Among his life experiences, Stevens has met 7 presidents of the United States, flown with the Navy's Blue Angels, piloted a Los Angeles class nuclear submarine, and driven a NASCAR car at 140 miles an hour on a 1-mile oval. The football fan and avid golfer holds a master's in public affairs journalism from the University of Illinois Springfield, and lives in the Midwest with his children. May I present to you, to the country, to the world, Mr. Scott Stevens.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. There you go. You got the crowd there, too.
Good afternoon, Bob.
Hey, Steve. You know who we got with us, too? We got Dr. Jeanette Gallagher. Doctor.
It's always great to work with. It's always great to hear Dr. J.
There you
go. It is. Hi, everybody. Hey, Bob, I got a quick question for you. Who's going in and out on the sound? Is it me, or is it Scott, or is it you?
Nope, not here.
Okay.
I mean,
well,
as soon
no,
as,
it sounds great.
As soon as
you sound better now, huh?
Yeah, as soon as somebody said anything, the first thing I was doing was I had every graft up that you could possibly think of, and they were all straight across, so I said, not me.
Oh, okay. Good. It sounds better now.
Yeah, there you go.
Thanks. I'm so glad everybody's here tonight. You know, I think this is a great topic, Bob. You know, we would like to talk about this before the holidays because I think sometimes people end up in the ER, people end up in rehab, people end up dead around the holidays because of alcohol, you know.
You said
and
it.
To be really blunt about it, you know, we have to be able to talk about this openly and freely, and that's what we've always done.
You know, it's really funny, though, too, and I'm sure that Scott is definitely going to agree with me on this. Anybody who don't know their limit isn't all there. I mean, their friends aren't around them. I mean, people they're with and everything else. I mean, let's face it. Even if you think you got a buzz, don't drive.
Exactly. It's amazing that you bring this up because just a week ago, there was a study that came out that indicated that what we've all known, or anybody who's lived a life challenged with alcohol, is that we have no ability to gauge our own level of intoxication.
No.
It was in Denmark, and they went bar to bar talking to people, you know, and say, hey, how buzzed do you feel? Well, I feel fine. Well, then they breathalyzed them, and boom, you know, you're three times the legal limit to drive, which is lower over there. But still, the point is that, you know, this is a mind-altering drug, and of course you're not going to be able to gauge your own level of drunkenness. And that's how we get people who mix alcohol and gasoline.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, that's a good analogy.
Well, you know, Scott, you and I have spoken about this many times before, and I've spoken with Bob about it, is that, you know, we see CVS, the drugstore chain. They turned around, they said, tobacco's bad for you, it's got to go.
Mm-hmm.
Now they bought Aetna, so they're going to rule our health care, because they're also a pharmacy and they dispense drugs. However, in all those same aisles now, they've got even more liquor in my CVS, in my area.
Here too.
There's at least 8 aisles of hard liquor, beer, and wine. You just walk in and get it. It's not behind a counter. You don't have to ask for it. You don't need to show hardly anything in these days, and you just go and you get what you want, and you go out. So really, where is the, you know, we like to say that we're making better changes in our lives, and, oh, everybody knows about drinking and driving and all this. I think it's gotten more common as a beverage for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I mean, I live in New Orleans. They put booze and donuts here, you know? So, I mean, it's gotten to be such a common thing that I think we've lost all sense of being to make any judgment calls, yes?
It's true. It's true. And, you know, I'm up here in Wisconsin, the land of beer, so we mix it with ice cream. So.
Right. Yeah.
I know exactly what he's talking about because I played up there. they're close to Canadians.
Yep.
Eh? Absolutely.
Where we're starting to see a sea change is the way we have this dialogue around alcohol, and it began at least a decade ago, but we're picking up momentum now and changing the way that we talk about alcohol, not what it does for you, but what it does to you. There was a Surgeon General's report that finally came out last fall. I followed up with my fourth book on that one, because the Surgeon General, for the first time ever, started talking about alcohol as a drug, which it is, and the health consequences aside from car wrecks or cirrhosis of the liver or the disease of alcoholism, talking about its role as a carcinogen. Now, we can backtrack this whole conversation back to 1964 when the Surgeon General said, hey, smoking might not be all that good for you. In the year I was born, 1967, 92% of the adult males in this country smoked. Today, 92% don't. And that's because they changed the dialogue back then from what smoking does for you, makes you look glamorous, makes you look cool. At one point, they even says it helps cure the cough. Well, we know that that was never quite true. And now we're finding out, or we're at least the word is getting out, what we've known for over a decade, and that this thing causes cancer. This is a drug that is not only a known carcinogen, but also it's a toxin. And Dr. J, as a doctor, you know that, you know, sooner or later, if you're putting a carcinogen and a toxin in your body, the results are not going to be unicorns and rainbows.
I got a question. I got a quick question.
Sure.
Isn't it a shorter line between life and death with alcohol than it is with smoking cigarettes?
Really, apples and oranges.
Not necessarily, yeah.
Because you know, you're dealing with two different bodily systems. You're talking about your respiratory system and then the rest of your body, basically, with alcohol. Because while it enters your digestive system, it quickly enters the bloodstream,
yeah,
and you're off to the races with the damage that it does to every system in your body, including the immune system, the central nervous system, etc. So we're the risk primarily with smoking has been associated with the respiratory system, and then the adverse consequences of untreated lung cancer or emphysema. With alcohol, you're basically introducing a toxin right directly into the bloodstream.
Yeah, exactly. There's no shortcut. It's just boom, there.
Yeah, so to your point, yeah, there's a more direct line, but it's just I wouldn't play with either.
no, of course not. But you know,
I think what we're really done though is that they've with both of them, with alcohol and tobacco, is that the results. I mean, the problems start right when you first start engaging in both practices. It's just that how much do we want to emphasize in the society and in the media of how bad it actually gets. In other words, we don't put ads on the television for tobacco until they've got a stoma and they're walking around with how long does my oxygen cord go, you know? But really, decades and decades before that, those people were not able to breathe. Their skin started to shrivel up. Their bones were not working that well. Their hair was falling out. So all of these things were going on. It's just we didn't bother to do anything about it because, hey, you know, they're smokers, you know, whatever. So we're doing the same thing with alcohol, you know, but we're kind of like romanticizing the darn stuff. But if you look at it really, Scott, we are romanticizing it because what is many of the drugs, when they're made in liquid form or some other substances, they need a carrier, and their carrier is alcohol. Same thing with the dental profession. What is in mouthwash? Alcohol, you know, what are in these substances that you see on the shelves? Alcohol, what's in, you know, all these different things like cough medicines and stuff. My son had said to me, he said, yeah, I went to a concert and I just did Robo. He says, you know, you drink four bottles of Robitussin and then you go to the concert, because he didn't have money for street drugs that day, you know. So that's what these kids are doing, and it's just we are putting a blind eye because we're giving it a different name just to glamorize it, right?
It's when I talk about drinking, even as to your point, starting with the first drink is when the damage begins. And when I say it, it's like when you take your first drink, you're stepping out into the road. The truck just hasn't hit you yet.
Correct.
And it's a matter of time. Of course, the amount over time, you know, all these factors contribute to the extent of the damage and how quickly it's going to hit you. But it's going to hit you. It's going to shave years off your life expectancy, whether you consider yourself a moderate drinker or, as the beverage companies term it, drinking responsibly. Frankly, there is no responsible way to drink a known toxin and carcinogen. Pure and simple.
I mean, you can lace it up and you could do it however you want. You know, you could throw a little ice cream in with it and some sprinkles and call it, you know, a dessert. I mean, we are really, really romanticizing it. And we're making it so that even other people who would never think of drinking around the holidays, they're just like, oh, yeah, let me have a drink. You know, I never do drink or, you know, it's not in my thing. And, oh, that looks so good. And they end up having food with that has alcohol. You know, we have spaghetti with vodka these days, you know, or we have donuts with, you know, Southern Comfort in them, or pudding, you know, like Bananas Foster. Hey, you know, pour a little rum on there. And what happens is a lot of times around the holidays, people end up in the ER or dead because it reacts with their medications. And they had little do they even think that the alcohol in which they had in their food or maybe just randomly had interacted with those medications.
And it doesn't take much alcohol to interact with medications. There's more than 210 medications that adversely interact with alcohol, anything from heart pills to simple herbal concoctions, St. John's wort among them, that, you know, people don't think, well, or when they make this connection between alcohol and interactions, they're thinking, oh, I've got to drink a case of beer in order for that to happen. And no, that's not the case at all. It just takes a very minor amount. And one of the situations that people will find themselves in when they're taking an anti-anxiety medication, like benzodiazepines are the pharmacist name for these things, but they go by the names of like Ativan and, you know, things that are supposed to calm you down for anxiety. However, when mixed with alcohol, you're not just, it's the equivalent of, instead of drinking one beer, it's like drinking six because it amplifies the effects. So, you know, the similar amplification effect can happen with over-the-counter medications or prescription medications. And also what you'll see is that in the case of beta blockers, other heart-related drugs, that they'll negate the effect that you're supposed to be getting from the drug. So if it's supposed to be lowering your cholesterol like a statin would, then you're just negating the reason why the doctor prescribed that drug for you in the first place.
And sometimes there's really a lot of interactions with the medications. Let's say we know grapefruit will inhibit some of the drugs, but then we turn around, we have a drink that with grapefruit in it, and it's inhibited the drug. The drug isn't saving you how it's supposed to. Now you've added alcohol, and there you can go. You know, can we say heart attack? Can we say stroke? Can we say convulsions? Can we say, you know, a diabetic storm, whatever you want to call it? The problem is that you just don't know enough yourself and you're not a chemist. The point is that chemistry is alcohol mixed with drugs in your body, and you're just performing an experiment. Yes.
It's a lethal experiment, and almost at any amount is going to have detrimental effects. It's, you know, when I look at 0.08, for example, you know, people think, well, I'm not impaired until I'm at 0.08, which is false. You're impaired with the very first drink at 0.02. So if that is impairing your judgment, your reaction time, that means you've altered your body chemistry, just like you've said.
Yeah, you know, I think that we've gotten that message from the medical community so much as they say, well, you don't have diabetes yet, so we're just going to, quote, watch your sugar until it goes up to a certain amount, and then we'll label you a diabetic. You know, or you don't have cancer yet, everything looks okay, but we'll keep an eye on you, and then all of a sudden one day, oh, your number went ding, 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 and now we're going to label you as such. That's the same thing with alcohol, you know, is that once you've had some, it's in your body. It's just when we get to a number, which society thinks is, quote, a problem, where we can, you know, put you in jail or whatever, then they're going to say it's ding, ding, ding. You know, that's the number, right?
Right. You know, finding the number or finding the label to put on that number. And it's a dangerous way to go about treating this beverage that's become, you know, so popular and you know, with the alcohol industry targeting a younger and younger crowd every year with these flavored malt beverages. I mean, they're creating the next generation of so-called alcoholics before we can get the first generation of alcoholics off of the drug itself and into sobriety.
Speaking of that, there is a couple of questions that I have that's coming in from the crowd.
Right.
And two of them I'm going to stick together. One of them is, they're number one of two, is in your own words, what is alcoholism? And the second one is alcoholism a behavior issue?
Okay. It's not a behavioral issue. It is a medical condition. It's a disease, just like you would classify diabetes, since we were just talking about that, or heart disease. This is a medical condition. And what if you were to compare alcohol abuse to alcoholism? An alcohol abuser can quit but won't. An alcoholic wants to quit but can't.
Wow, that's a good way of putting it.
And it's from my own experience there. Alcohol was my friend for a number of years. I could live with it. I could live without it. I could have two beers and not make anything of it. I could have a 12-pack and still want more. Part of the phenomenon of the disease of addiction is the concept of craving. And a non-alcoholic will crave their first drink. An alcoholic will crave their 13th, 14th, and 15th. So it's just a matter of, you know, frankly dread the first drink, because we know that it's impossible to gauge how long or how many you're going to be drinking.
Well, here's one, you know. Another question just popped up. Are the 12 steps the only reliable modality for recovery?
Absolutely not. No.
No.
Where I fall on that is if you're worshiping crop circles and it keeps you sober, by all means do it. I've started a group called Men for Sobriety, which is based off of Women for Sobriety, which was started as an alternative to the 12 steps. There's also Smart Recovery. There's secular orders of sobriety. There's a number of different ways that people have addressed the disease of addiction. The 12 steps is the most common and many times the most controversial, because there's a degree of spirituality in there that some people just don't or won't buy into. Where all of these come down is if that's what it takes to get you sober and keep you sober, do it.
There's also the idea about rehabs, too. Mm-hmm. Many times kids will find themselves in a rehab or family members around the holidays. I know my own experience with having family members or acquaintances in rehabs. It could be something for a weekend. It could be, you know, the 120 turnaround. It could be 90 days. It could be 3 years. And really, what it's all about is, what's it going to take to get you to that day that you're leaving and you say, okay, I'm not going to drink anymore. It may take you one day, it may take you 90 days, it may take you 3 years. But on that second day that you're out, and the third day you're out, and the fourth day you're out, you may totally go back again. You know, you may totally revert again. And I think, Scott, we always want to talk about that, is that rehab is not meant to cure you. Rehab is meant to shake you awake or to keep you where you are. And it's going to keep you maybe stable or somewhat in a holding pattern until you think of something, feel something, change something, and then you're on your way out. It does not cure you. It doesn't do anything. You really have to do the work, and you have to figure out, you have to figure out where you are and be able to do what you can to live safely after that. Mm-hmm. It's not, you don't go into rehab and they're going to shake you silly and they're going to bring you to your knees and you're going to get out and, hey, you know, what's across the street? Ooh, 7-Eleven. Hey, let me see, let me go see, you know, and that's the end of that. So I think it's So, Bob, to your question is that there's all these different types of therapies and treatments and books and stuff and stuff and stuff and stuff. But really, it's got to be your own plan.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be everybody else's template that you go around and you got to dig your hand into or spend all your money, and they're going to save you. Right, Scott? There's no damn saving here.
No.
The only person saving you is yourself.
It's a trap that especially the criminal justice system falls into, where they believe that there's a cookie cutter solution to this, and there is not. There's not an off the shelf that is going to apply to every single person. And you know, the way I look at it, and a lot of people in recovery look at it, is that there is no finish line. Okay.
Right.
Whether, you know, the insurance company says the finish line is 28 days from now, buddy, but that's far from the reality. 28 days, you're still raw. You are still you're still pretty near flammable at some, you know, for some people, like the amount and quantities that I consumed. But the point being is that 28 days is just a starting point. Whether you're there 3 months or three
right.
years, you still got to live the rest of your life. And, mm-hmm. you know, for me being 8 years sober now, I'm not going to say I struggle like I did 8 days sober, but there are still days where you just say, you know, what's the point here? And then I recall that, okay, the point is my two kids. The point is the rebuilding of my life that I've done so far. And am I willing to toss that away for a quick buzz and or a quick amount of stress relief? Non-alcoholics and alcoholics alike drink for the same reason, and that's to relieve stress. Well,
okay.
The consequences aren't worth it for me, so I find other ways to relieve my stress.
Don't you think that the main reason I've also, I guess we could rephrase that in another way some might think about, is that it might, that you'll say I'm not stressed, because a lot of people don't equate to the word stress because they feel that that's a failure. But some, I would almost say that it takes you to a different spot. So in other words, whatever you are in right now,
mm-hmm.
you want to be somewhere else. So if you have physical pain, you want out of it. If you have head pain, you want out of it. If you're in a stressful situation, you want out of it. If you're in an argument with someone, you want out of it. If you are being pointed at because you did something wrong or you're a failure, you want out of it. So really what alcohol does is it takes you from wherever you are to a different place, yes?
Yeah, that's very true. And it's a matter of, you know, if you fold your arms in front of you, and then
right.
unfold them and fold them back with the opposite hand on top. The hand that was on the bottom, put it on top. It feels uncomfortable. And going from an active alcoholic to a person in long-term recovery, it's making that uncomfortable part feel comfortable without
right.
having to chemically alter yourself. There are a lot of drugs out there, whether it's opioids or weed or alcohol. And, you know, I could always get where I wanted to get with alcohol. So I didn't have
right.
a relationship with any of those other drugs. But my relationship with this particular drug is what nearly cost me my life, which, you know, had legal consequences in addition to who knows yet, but health consequences could be further down the road. I don't know this for a fact, but
okay.
the bottom line is, okay, that uncomfortable part has to feel comfortable for me, or I'm going to continue to do those. I'm going to continue to have those consequences. So finding a different way to get comfortable without chemically altering my brain, messing with
right.
the serotonin and dopamine, and you know, I've gotta live my life in a way that says, okay, alcohol isn't, we can cross that one off the list because that isn't going to get me where I need to get anymore.
You know, I think we've gotten as a society, I'll use this loosely. It's not everyone. It's just it's random times I've heard it, sensed it, and noticed it, is that we've gotten to be very wimpy adults, you know, because anytime something hurts, we got to run for the Advil, you know. Oh, we got a headache, got to run for something else. Oh, the doctor says I'm getting sniffles, I got to go run for something else, you know. Instead of kind of working through some of these, in other words, and getting, sometimes people say, well, what do you do? You're saying I have to ignore it? And it's almost like you have to walk through it to have a flak jacket to say, you know, I'm going to be okay. I know I can do it, you know? And to not always have that backup plan that's going to always shortchange you, you know, like spark you out of whatever it is. And I think a lot of times people, when they say they're going towards, you know, towards that suicidal-like thoughts, it's because they're always looking for that shortchange that's going to click them out of it. They're trying to find that one thing that will really shortchange them so that they don't end up hanging by their nails over the edge of the cliff, right?
Right. I want to get better quicker.
Yeah.
And whatever takes, you know, whether it's an over-the-counter solution in the pharmacy or an over-the-counter solution in the liquor store or wherever else they'll find it, you know, whatever we can. You know, if you want to look at it as being a pleasure society, yeah, that's true. So were the Greeks back then. You know,
it's
human nature to a large extent to not suffer or to find the shortest way out. And in the case of alcoholism or the disease of addiction and addiction in general, there is no quick way out. You can't cut corners. You've got to the only way is through it. You can't go around it.
Yeah.
Hey, here's one for you. We watch TV every day. We see people that all say at the end of the show, well, come on, let's get a drink. And it's something that is subliminal. I mean, it's something that's a message that comes out from all these shows.
Yep.
Every single one. I mean, have any one of you ever not sat down in front of a TV and seen at least two out of three shows with an ending that's similar?
Shut it off.
And that, Bob, is why we don't have the dialogue about alcohol as a drug.
Right.
Because we have this as part
it's
of our
acceptable.
Entertainment and also what is bankrolling our entertainment.
Yes.
Your television, when every time you click that on, the folks at Anheuser-Busch are glad you did.
That's right.
Well, you know, I always say all the time that people are paying for cable, right? So you pay,
yeah.
It goes up and up and up and up and up. And, you know, they say, oh, well, don't worry about it. That's, you know, the raise of, you know, the whatever they got there. There are gauges in that to tell you that it's going to be more money. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you get six, seven, I mean, I count them on TV. I mean, maybe I'm just crazy. But, I mean, you know, it's statistics or something that goes through my mind all the time. And I'll see 13 ads in a row. Some of them 15 seconds, some of them 30 seconds, some of them 45, some of them a minute. Depends upon who pays what. But you've got all those ads down there. So that company that's running those ads is making millions of dollars on these ads. Meanwhile, they're raising your rate. Why? I mean, it's like, hey, and they're telling you that alcohol is okay. And how many shows now also, and I just got something that just popped up on the screen, how many people now are actually looking at people doing drugs on TV?
Right.
Well, especially in the days of cable and, you know, what we've once considered as a 50-year-old man, I can't say that forever it's been this way, but we had a more prudent or more prudish look at what our entertainment values were, say, three decades ago.
No way
are we going to show that on TV, and now it's on 400 of my 600 cable channels.
You know, they say you can't say that four-letter word, you know, on TV.
Right.
The one that begins with F?
Yeah.
Somebody said it on the news the other day, and I almost fell out of my couch. I mean, I was sitting there going, what?
Yeah.
And it was somebody who was on, you know, they were doing on the site that they were at, right? And he said, what the? And I was like, oh, my God. And, I mean, let's face it, like you're saying, 30 years ago, what would happen to that guy? They'd have him behind bars. The FCC would disavow his kids.
Yeah, George Carlin would be making fun of him.
Bingo, yeah. Oh, yeah. But,
you know,
I mean,
but we see it on social media, too, now because of the holidays. You know, you could click on Facebook, and there's 100 recipes for the next best drink, you know, and how to incorporate booze into all your food. And also, too, you know, I've even said, I said to my husband one day, I says, you know, it's really strange. I don't understand how those newscasters can sit there day after day reading this stuff. You know, it's like, what kind of morals do they even have these days, you know? So it's really difficult to be able to, I guess, become numb to what's really going on in the world around us, don't you think?
And the it's great that you brought up social media, because that is still the wild, wild west out there. Whether it's Facebook or Snapchat. In fact, Snapchat, I went off on them on alcoholicist.com on my blog about a month ago. I'm standing next to my son at a Milwaukee Bucks game, and I look over, he's Snapchatting, and I saw on his phone an ad for Michelob Ultra. And I'm like, whoa, wait, back up. And of course, at first he thought I was upset with him. And I said, no, I'm not upset with you, but let me see that. And of course he shows it to me. We've got a decent level of trust between us. And he says, Dad, I don't know where that came from. And I said, I sure do.
Yeah, right.
And, I took off. I mean, my kid is 17. And especially in the case of social media, where you plug in your age, and he didn't fudge it on his Snapchat. Mm-hmm. You know, he put his real age in there, or his real birth date in there, and they still delivered him an ad that he's not old enough to buy or consume. So that's part of this wild, wild west mentality of social media. And part of the problem is also that alcohol ads are self-regulated by the very industry who's putting out the ads.
Exactly.
So, I don't ask my mother-in-law to arbiter a marital dispute. So I'm certainly not going to trust alcohol industry to police their pick up after their own dog.
Well, it's just a mass blast ad. That's all. They don't care where they go as long as they hit a number.
Right.
Exactly. They've delivered the content, and they have the opportunity to very highly target where those ads go. That is the glory of advertising on social media, is if you want to hit 15-and-a-half-year-old girls with red hair, you're able to clearly define your audience that specifically, if you so choose. So, you know, when you get into things like Snapchat or Facebook, those kind of ads are delivered with intent.
Here's a question. I apologize. There was another one that came up. Are there varieties of alcohol or drug abusers? That was a weird question.
Is it individual as the day? I mean, a variety.
Like it says, different phases of addiction.
Mm-hmm. They're in. This depends on the source, the literature. I mean, I've seen anywhere from 5 to 12 different categories of alcoholics. Okay, this is considered mild, or this is a severe case. This is incurable, or you know what? Alcoholism as a disease does not have a cure. So, you know, it's all window dressing. It's all somebody trying to sell a book or trying to sell a concept. But the fact is that this is a disease that you don't want. So do you I'm only a mild alcoholic, so I must be better than Scott, the severe alcoholic. No, it doesn't work that way. It's just like being pregnant. You're not a little bit pregnant.
Mm-hmm. It's like, why are you quantifying it or qualifying it? It is what it is. I mean, that's really what they're doing, is justifying their poor responsibility or actions, period.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. You're looking for a way out of the severity of the situation that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I've got an alcohol problem, but I'm stage one. I'm not stage 26.
Right.
Hey, here's one. Here's one for you. This one's gonna blow both of you away. Who's responsible for the car accident where people are killed by a drunken driver? Is it the drunken driver or the bar he came out of?
Can you really say the responsibility? Can you just say it happened and just work? You got to work on all the aspects, don't you think, Scott?
Well, this one came up with the law.
When we start to keep pointing the fingers at everybody, we could then get in a pointing finger problem, instead of getting to a solution or help or support for those that need it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's similar to the opioid crisis that we're in. A lot of people want to point fingers at the pharmaceutical companies. Others want to point it at the doctor who prescribed it in the first place or overprescribed it. And others want to point
victims. Yeah.
Right. So the victim mentality has to stop. And you know, the tendency with alcohol is to say, oh, well, that clown shouldn't have been behind the wheel, or somebody in that bar should have grabbed his keys, or the bartender shouldn't have served him, or Jack Daniels shouldn't have made it 80 proof. They should have made it 60 proof. You know, you can run down every rabbit trail you want, and you're still trying to identify a cause and therefore identify a victim.
Well, I think that we're looking for responsibility.
You're really trying to just point fingers at somebody because you want to have revenge or you want to put the blame. Who's the blame? If you turn on the TV and you're watching alcohol commercials, you're to blame because you've now watched the commercial. I mean, we could take this a bazillion different ways. The whole really thing about it is about making values and choices every day that don't support them. Like, are you going to go to a football game that, you know, they're giving out free beers from 3 to 6? Don't go, you know? So it's about being responsible people in the world. If you want to make a change, you've got to decide to make the change instead of just saying, I'll let somebody else do it. It doesn't bother me. It's no big deal to me. You know, I'm going to just have positive attitude. It affects everybody. It's everybody's. It's the world you live in. Right?
True. It's, you know, if we want to, if we look at the responsibility, for example, for drunk driving, or I'd say impaired driving, because I sure didn't feel drunk when I did it, but I know I was impaired. But I didn't know I was impaired at the time. I thought I was fine. Back to that original thing that I talked about at the top of the show. When you're under the influence of a mind-altering drug, don't ask that same mind to evaluate your present situation, because it's not possible. So, you know, do I take full responsibility for driving impaired? You bet I do. If you asked me at that time, I still would have said, I'm fine. I feel fine. But, you know, that was the point of taking the drug to begin with, that I felt fine. You know, if you want to look at the bartender's responsibility, well, if I don't serve it to him, the guy next door will. And a bartender is a bar is a business. You know, I don't fault them, and I don't clear them either. They certainly have skin in this game, just like everybody else. But to take a more mature look at the use of this drug and the serving of this drug and the packaging of this drug is, like I said, we're at the start of a sea change where by the end of this decade, just 2 short years from now, I believe we will not see alcohol advertising on television anymore. And you know, within 10 years, we're going to have the same, you know, the alcohol business can look at where the tobacco business is now, and that's where they're going to be in 10 years.
But also, too, when you walk into a bar, you're the one who's walking in. They're not outside, you know, serving you as you pass by and by osmosis, you know. In other words, you are doing an action. You are, you know, a customer. You are looking for a product. You are in an actual engagement. So it's really, I mean, well, we really want to lay the force, you know, on grocery stores that sell it or on bartenders or whatever. It's still, you walked into their establishment, you know. So,
and,
I mean, that has a lot of weight.
A ton of weight, because in the case of me as an alcoholic, the only drink I have control over is the first one. That's it. So if I don't take that first one, I don't have to worry about getting behind the wheel. I don't have to worry about the legal or the physical consequences. And that's where we begin to just say, knock off the crap with this being safe or healthy or life improving. There isn't a situation I know of that has gotten better because of alcohol use. None. And the more that we emphasize the health consequences and get away from the only consequences of alcohol use are cirrhosis, car wrecks, or the disease of alcoholism, the more we bring it down to a level that people can understand that this is a carcinogen. There are other health consequences that this will bring about. You know, then we continue to change the dialogue.
You know, let's talk for a second, Scott, about this, because I think it's important, you know, as we're coming up on the holidays, is that if you have an alcohol issue, if you have relatives with it or family members or whatever, it's important to address it. It's important to open it up, because the more you try to hide it, the worse it can get under the skin. But also, too, the idea that if people are having a problem, get help. I mean, I know with many of the members that, you know, the people that I have worked with and all of the acquaintances that I've had is that you can go to rehab one time, you can go to rehab 100 times. I don't care. Just keep going, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think for people to, number one, not give up, because you've been to rehab many times, is not give up and to bring it out in the open. But for also for people to say, I'm not going to talk about it because I might lose my husband. I might lose my job. Oh, my kids don't want to know about it. Let me tell you, your job, your kids, and your husband already know about it, and they're on their last leg anyway.
Yeah,
so
every one
if you're
of them.
Just, yeah, if you're just holding it on because of what you think in your head, I can guarantee you whatever you're thinking in your head, you're 100% wrong, you know? Mm-hmm. So, but I think also the idea of, like, push it to go. Push it to get help. Even if you fail at the first 99 times, it does not matter. It's that you keep going, you know, and keep going through it and keep going, right?
Especially with on the topic of relapse, right? there's no shame. This is a relapsing disease. 9 out of 10 alcoholics relapse.
Right.
God bless the one who didn't, but you know it's a reality for 9 out of 10 of us. But that's no different than the disease of diabetes. You know, where you can just do something as relatively simple as making dietary adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those things happen. These are relapsing diseases because aside from being a miraculously self-healing organism, our bodies also are attached to a brain that says, "Oh, I got this. I can go on. I can. Hey, look, I'm fine so far, or
right.
I can address this tomorrow." Well, what if there isn't a tomorrow?
I mean, even like with a heart attack, you know, you have a heart attack and they have horrible life up till then and they get their bypass and say, I'm good to go and go right back to their old ways, you know. So in other words, our body is telling us something and it's saying, you know, I'm kind of uncomfortable in this position. Can we try something else? And what you and I are both saying and Bob is saying is get the help to be able to see what that other thing feels like.
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel to not drink tomorrow? How does it feel for your body to be able to get up? How does it feel to not throw up for 24 hours? How does it feel to actually smell your cologne instead of smelling like you've been in a bar, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't really connected in our head those things that could potentially be different if we aren't out of them for a period of time, right?
Exactly. And you know, that brings up the holidays in general in that, you know, why is there a hesitation around the holidays to address this? Maybe they're not going to be around, you know, maybe they're miserable around Christmas because they're horrible to be around. They're angry, they're grumpy, they stink, they're passed out on the couch. Well,
right.
You know, that is the ideal time rather than waiting till after the holidays to say, okay, look, this is... And every one of us alcoholics has a moment of lucidity at some point along the line here to have that dialogue with them to say, hey, it's time. Because, you know, we all need to hear that, and we need to hear it again and again because it does make a difference. And it doesn't matter if it's the holidays, because what if the holidays are miserable with them there now, but what if this disease kills them in the next year? So,
and when people say, too, they'll say, oh, well, you're not going to ruin the holiday for me. Well, you know, if maybe tonight he doesn't get up tomorrow, well, I guess he screwed up the holiday, didn't he? You know, But it's also his life that's a difference of hers. And it's, you know, we always want to say, who's doing it to me? You know, they aren't doing it to you. That's their life experience, and we're observing it.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't doing anything to you. Do you know what I mean? In essence, they may be making your life uncomfortable. They'd be making it not the greatest holiday or whatever. However, they aren't, quote, doing anything to you. It's your perception of it. So if you can help them, it would be a great holiday. You would say, isn't it fabulous? You know, we're going to go visit them because it's a great place to be, and we know that we're able to get some help for now. You
mm-hmm.
know? So in other words, celebrate that progress versus always trying to say, you know, the other way, that victim orientation, yeah?
Mm-hmm. And that's a great segue to this being a family disease. This isn't just the alcoholic's problem. The whole family is sick because mm-hmm. they've had to adjust their lives around that person. It changes the entire dynamic of the family.
I have a
medical condition. I have a physical disease, but it's creating all sorts of diseases right around me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of tough on the family too. I mean, look at the divorce rate, for crying out loud. I mean, you know, there's so many out there, and that all because mm-hmm. of the same thing. You know, it's drugs or drunk. One of the two.
But it's not a bad thing, Bob. It's a process of life. In other words, it got them to that point. It's actually better for alcoholics to experience a divorce, because then that will throw them into rehab, or that will throw them into a different position. In other words, these things that we categorize as bad holiday, bad divorce, bad leave work, they're actually leaping posts into the next chapter, don't you think, Scott?
Yeah, the consequences. I mean, sometimes it's a nudge from the judge. Sometimes it's the wife saying, "I'm done." It's the kids not wanting to see you. These consequences are a lot of times the impetus for change, and that can be a beneficial thing. For some people, they may momentarily take that as the excuse to, okay, I'm running off the rails now, and I can speak from experience there. Following my second divorce, I immediately got 4 drinking and driving arrests in 6 weeks because mm-hmm. I said, you know what, alcohol ain't the problem here. Let me show you. And, I showed them all right. So, you know, it's all in how you take the consequences, but sooner or later the consequences stack up to say, oh, okay, the problem is me in my relationship with alcohol. It's not what Jeanette or Bob think about my drinking. The problem mm-hmm. is my drinking.
You know, you said
but
it.
But, I
you
mean,
said
when you're hanging
there.
Over the edge by your fingernails, it's only you that's there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you've got to come.
You know, you made it personal there for a second, Scott. The
yeah.
relationship with the alcohol.
Yeah.
That was excellent. I've never thought of it like that before. That's the first time that really got me.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, well, people do have that relationship with it. I mean, it's something that they either can live, like you said, with it or without it.
Mm-hmm. At one point, you know, I believed alcohol was my friend, that I could get anywhere I needed to get with alcohol, that it wasn't harming my life. And then all of a sudden, alcohol turned on me, and this relationship went bad. But that's part of it's environmental. Part of it is genetic. There are there's a whole constellation of things that come into forming the disease of alcoholism. It's not just limited to one. And part of it was my own perception of the disease that I had, and it not causing problems nothing causes problems until it does.
You know, I read a lot of things on addictions. I mean, I've got, I tell you, my library loves me. But the one thing that comes up a lot in that stuff is people or writers say that the family has a history of, and I don't believe that. You know, it's not passed down in genes, I don't think.
It is to a point. For example, there are studies linking it to flaws in chromosomes 4, Q, and 11.
Yeah.
So yeah, that means I have a predisposition to the disease of alcoholism. But no alcoholic ever became alcoholic without taking that first drink. So that's where the genetic factors bump up against the environmental factors, that being the household that I grow up in. Mm-hmm. For example, my dad, every day he got home from work, he popped open a nice cold can of PBR. So mm-hmm. that was the lesson I learned, that is the male pattern I need to follow, that when I get home from work, I pop
right.
open a beer.
Right.
So
societal conditioning.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I mentioned, it's a constellation of factors. It's not limited to just one, but heredity, it does play a role in, you know, the genes. But here's the thing, and boy, I didn't bring this up yet. Alcohol, as a toxin, it modifies, it can change your DNA.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Think about that for a second.
That would
Think
be
about that. That is how powerful this toxin is. It can alter your DNA. So you might not have been born genetically predisposed to alcoholism, but the more you pour that toxin into your body, the more you're altering your body's makeup. You're changing your body at the molecular level. That's powerful stuff. Nothing you find on a bikini-filled Budweiser commercial, for sure.
Yeah, well, that's true, yes. You know, seriously speaking, I mean, that's probably right net about the DNA, but, you know, as far as alcohol and that is concerned, I mean, I've seen people that totally, thinking about it, ruin their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about it. I mean, they knew what they were doing, but they still mm-hmm. did it anyway.
It's a slippery slope.
Worse than that, right, Jeanette?
Yeah, you know, it can also go, you know, along with street drugs. It can go along with mm-hmm, getting prescriptions,
right.
doctor shopping. All these things are all combined together. Everybody kind of has an instinct. They know in their life what they're doing, you know, eating fast food, having poor relationships. It's really, I almost, you know, we always want to find a solution, a reason why, so we can, quote, fix it. But really, I look at alcoholism as the leaves on the tree. I look at a bad diet, leaves on the tree. Diabetes, leaves on the tree. All of those are different participants, each leaf is, in how you got there, how you're going to get out of it, and what you need to look at, you know? Alcoholism mm-hmm. could mean you don't go down the same street to go to work. Alcoholism could mean you don't have a cell phone. Alcoholism could mean you drive with your windows open. Or it could mean that you don't eat certain foods or you don't go to the certain restaurant that's serving, you know, free drinks with all of their food. So, in other words, there's bazillions of different reasons and ways to be able to maneuver through life. It's just what chooses to rear its head that day.
Yeah, here's one for you. This is a good question now, really. This is the way it comes through. I'm going to try to make it easy on your ears.
Okay.
It says, Mr. Stevens has met 7 presidents of the United States. Why? a little political there.
To
have a drink or
well,
something?
I started my career as a reporter, so in covering politics over a period of time, I got to meet Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush. Did not meet Mr. Obama. I did meet Mr. Trump before he was our distinguished leader. This was back in the 80s when he was nothing more than a overconfident businessman who had a somewhat of an empire going on. But through my reporting career, that's how I got to do a lot of the things that I did. And guess what? Back then, I didn't drink because drinking was career suicide at that
right.
point. If somebody
exactly.
spotted you at a bar, forget it. You're off the air, buddy. So, I mean, this is the late night or late 80s, early 90s at the time. So, but that's how a lot of my just fantastic life experiences have come about is through my career as a reporter. And I'm one of the lucky people who have not only lived their dream job once, but twice, because I'm back to reporting now after a couple of decades in the financial services industry. It's all come full circle. I'm writing books. I'm writing articles. I'm doing my blog on a regular basis and, going back to my roots, doing the thing that I love, not a second time around.
You know, we were all given a path when we were born. We didn't know it, but it was there. And you did it. I did it. Dr. Janet did it. We've all come 360 in some way. Something that was our passion when we started our careers, we wind up doing them all over again. I mean, mine was entertainment, and I went into financial. For a little over 20 years. And what do? I semi-retire and I go back to entertainment again.
Go back to the love right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like golf. It's a good thing they don't put pictures on the scorecard because this journey I've been on and, other people with my disease, the journey isn't all that glorious, but damn, the results are awesome.
I played golf one time when it was a company outing. I went back to the place that you go and have lunch and that or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I said I got my game card in my hand, right? I said, I won. And they go, what are you crazy? What do you mean you won? I got 115.
Day.
I didn't know you needed a lower number. What did I know,
Yeah, it's that lower score. Like,
I'm telling you, there was about 50, 60 people there, and they weren't drinking. They were crying in their drinks. They were dying. they were crying. That's how hard they were laughing.
Yeah, Bob shut down the 19th hole.
Oh, yeah. I almost killed an old man on one of them. The ball went to somebody else's hole. But anyway... So much for what we got to do. You know what, really, I think the passion that we really need is more love in what we're doing of each other, enough to take care of each other and tap somebody on the shoulder and say, look, man, you ain't driving tonight.
Mm-hmm.
That's love. It really, really is. More than you'll ever know when you do something like that. I know the person might get a little ticked off of you and say, oh, you can't have my keys. Don't worry about it. You'll get them away from him somehow or another. He'll put them down on the bar, and when he's not looking, they've just disappeared miraculously.
You're exactly right on this, and that amount of compassion, that amount of caring, that amount of love, is it saves lives. Because if you care enough about someone to talk to them about their drinking, from the alcoholic's standpoint, when I talk about those moments of lucidity, you think, oh God, that person must really care about me because, look what I'm doing. Look what I'm doing to myself. Look what I'm doing to the people around me. And if you're presently in the grips of the disease of alcoholism, if somebody takes the time, love, and compassion to tell you they're concerned about your drinking, listen to them, because they may have been sitting on that thought for a month, a year, a decade. But they said it because they love you.
That's right.
And I think so, too. Just real quick in closing, I think that and if they're not at the point where you can listen to them, don't give up on those people. Still bring them to the place. Take them to a rehab place. Take them to a meeting. Take them somewhere to get them help. Because it does reach a point, and you know this, Scott, is where you can't make those decisions. Someone else needs to make it for you.
Mm-hmm.
Or someone else needs to take you to that place so that you're able to, even be able to save you at the last second or whatever it is. So if you see someone that's like that and they really are not able to make any decisions whatsoever, you can take them and get them help.
Mm-hmm. It's a nudge, but it's in the right direction.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yep.
Dr. Janet, do you want to close it up?
Yeah, and Scott, can you share a little bit more information about how to find out about you? That would be great.
Sure. My website is alcoholologist.com. That's alcoholologist.com. com, and my books are found on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere else that you'd find books. Just look for Scott Stevens, and the four books are What the Early Worm Gets, Every Silver Lining Has a Cloud, Adding Fire to the Fuel, and I Can't See the Forest with All
yes.
These Damn Trees in the Way.
I love that
so
book.
I've had a few little fun with words, but each of those books talks about the drug, alcohol, the disease of addiction, right. Relapse, and recovery. But alcoholologist.com is like the pivot point for everything that I do.
Yeah, and it's really about being able to help each other the best you possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
There are no mistakes. This is all their process. There are no losers, you know. There's no one that's not worth it. Everybody is worth it. So really be able to reach out. And I think that's what this whole call was about, is reach out. You know, no matter what's going on, reach out and help someone, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely perfect. And Dr. Jeanette, the best lady in the world, thank you very much for being on the show tonight.
Great. Thank you, Bob.
Scott, you have to be back next year in 2018, because what we're going to do is we're going to come up on Easter time, and it's going to happen all over again.
It does. It doesn't have its own season. It's
no.
365.
Yes.
But
I'm Valentine's
glad to join you
Day
again.
You forgot.
Oh.
Well, okay, Valentine's Day, President's Day.
Oh, we got Mardi Gras here.
Oh, that's bad, though. That's really, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yep. There's no season for drinking.
No.
Drinking can be from 1 minute to the next.
Well, there you go.
I appreciate the opportunity, Bob and Dr. J. It's always great to speak with you, and
look forward
to doing this again.
All righty. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the end of another show, Highway to Recovery, with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher and Scott Stevens.